Sometimes you got to think big picture, right? Not what is going on today, but what is going to happen because of what is going on today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, the 10th of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Go ahead and tick them off on your fingers as I say them, if you feel like it. Congress is back in Washington. Yep. Healthcare in the Senate. Yep. Meetings with Russians. Yep. Tweets. Also, yep. Now, forget all of that, because like it or not, in our collective economic lives, it is not what is happening today that's the big story. It's the things that are going to happen in, say, the next 3 to 6 months that are going to matter more. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer gets us going.
As the Senate wrestles with health care legislation, it delays things like tax reform.
It actually adds about 60 more days or 2 months to the process.
That's Henrietta Trays of Veda Partners. She says Congress will probably still pass a tax reform bill this year, but it will be very limited because there's just no time to go through the process of hammering out a big picture bill.
With more time, you could conceivably spend more of your hours holding hearings, forming consensus, attempting to attract bipartisan support.
But if the healthcare debate spills into September or the Senate never does pass it, that could actually give a boost to tax reform, however limited, because Republicans would be under tremendous pressure to fulfill that promise, says Peter Cohn of Height Securities.
Politically, it certainly gives the tax reform effort a push in that it becomes really an absolute imperative for the Republicans to get across the finish line.
Looming in the background, a deadline for Congress to raise or extend the debt ceiling so the government doesn't run out of money. Oh, and there could be another government shutdown. Steve Bell is a former chief of staff at the Senate Budget Committee, now at the Bipartisan Policy Center. He says the prolonged health care debate has pushed back work on the spending bills Congress has to pass to prevent a shutdown. He says only fear of a shutdown or default on our debts will really motivate Congress.
I think that fear is what drives Congress to getting things done. Most of the time, they act out of fear, not out of good intentions.
And Bell says the markets will be watching, pricing in congressional action or inaction. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
A note on timing here for those of you minding your congressional calendars, you know who you are. The August recess starts in 3 weeks. They don't come back till after Labor Day. And yes, I know they did just get going again. All right, here's another story where the today is less important than the what happens next. President Trump, as you know, got back from the G20 over the weekend. He says the meeting in Hamburg was, quote, a great success. The White House says the communique after the summit included some of the Trump administration's top economic priorities. European leaders, as you might also know, saw it differently, objecting to U.S. protectionism on climate and global trade. So with that in mind, Marketplace's Annie Baxter does the medium-term economic cost-benefit analysis of the Trump administration's America First policy.
Just before the G20 summit, Japan and the European Union announced an agreement in principle for a new trade accord. And they touted free trade at a time when they see America shifting towards protectionism. Meanwhile, German Chancellor Angela Merkel called President Trump's decision to exit the Paris Climate Agreement deplorable and irreversible. She said the other signatories would proceed without the U.S.
You see that the rest of the world is starting to take real concerted steps to consolidate positions in opposition to the United States.
Nate Olson is a trade expert at the Stimson Center, a think tank. He says the administration's current approach could harm the economy. The Commerce Department is currently considering tariffs on steel imports for national security reasons. Olson says that could make steel costlier in the U.S., and it could prompt retaliation from trading partners like the EU. Olson says at the G20, EU leaders dangled the prospect of imposing tariffs on U.S. products, like whiskey.
They're looking for pain points.
Renegotiating the North American Free Trade Agreement with Canada and Mexico could be Trump's chance to clarify his goals, according to Simon Lester at the Cato Institute. Problem is, Lester says, Trump hasn't really signaled what he wants to change in that deal.
Part of that, I think, is the internal battles that are going on within the administration. They don't know yet where they're going to go.
Meanwhile, folks at the American Farm Bureau Federation are growing impatient. Chief Economist Bob Young says if Trump prefers bilateral trade deals to multilateral ones,
that's fine, but, let's get started.
And he says the sooner, the better. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Wall Street on this Monday, spare thought for Best Buy, would you? The latest victim of Amazon's quest for global economic domination. The tech site Recode reported today that Amazon is going to start up its own version of Best Buy's Geek Squad, the computer gadget repair service thing. Best Buy off 6%+ today. Amazon shares, it just kept rolling on higher. The major indices relatively calm. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You might never have heard of the News Media Alliance, but chances are you're familiar with their work. It's a newspaper trade group, counting among its members the biggies, the New York Times, the Journal, the Washington Post, but also dozens of local and regional papers, many of whom have fallen upon economically more difficult times, thanks, the group says, to Google and Facebook. It plans to ask Congress for permission to bargain collectively with the online conglomerates over ads and content deals without getting into antitrust trouble. For more, we got our senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood, on the line to make me smart. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
Tell me what these news outlets want, would you?
So they want to, at its heart, they want to be able to negotiate payment and distribution deals with Facebook and Google as a group. So instead of, you know, not just the New York Times, but instead of the Miami Herald or the Bismarck Tribune having to go and try to get a meeting with Facebook and Google and then make their own deal for revenue sharing or, you know, how customer data is distributed. They want to be able to do that collectively without getting accused of antitrust violations. So they're asking for a new law. And then they're also looking for better leverage so that they can get better deals than, for example, instant articles on Facebook, where papers essentially give away content for hardly any money. You know, yeah, they want to do better than that.
So let me actually just poke a sharp stick in the eye of the News Media Alliance, which is the name of this group, as I said. They didn't keep up digitally, and now they want special treatment.
Yeah, it's hard not to see it that way. In fact, the parallel for me is a little bit of the record industry when MP3s came out. And you could argue that they made very similar mistakes. The news business did not transition to digital soon enough to keep these ad dollars. They glommed on to the same kind of tactics that social media was using, clickbait and slideshows and sponsored content that alienated consumers. And then they did give away a ton of their content and their power to social media and to Google and Facebook because they thought it would be an easy way to reach audiences. And now they need help.
The business model of media, though, forever has been ads-based, right? And so how do we fix that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of these moves do assume that the business model has to be based on ads. What they're worried about is Google and Facebook sucking up all of these ad dollars. But they also want simple things like the ability to have a subscription button for a newspaper and ways to paywall articles that might help. The truth is, though, that strong media antitrust laws help protect media and could have solved some of these problems earlier. For example, a lot of what happened to local and mid-size daily newspapers is that they got bought by big companies like McClatchy or Lee Enterprises, which then consolidated, cut costs, laid off staff, you know, relied more on wire services. So you had weaker local news. That doesn't entice people to subscribe. That doesn't entice advertisers. And so some of these business problems are of the business's own making. Mm. And, you know, ganging up to negotiate better with Google and Facebook doesn't really help those fundamentals.
Molly Wood, she is our senior tech correspondent. We do a podcast together, too, by the by. It's called Make Me Smart. You can get it on Apple Podcasts, wherever you like. Check it out. Subscribe. Thanks, Molly.
Thanks, Kai.
There's a thing that happens as an economy changes. Life changes along with it, right? Where people live is different, how people live is different, and jobs are different. That right there, the jobs, is our slice. What happens in communities that lose jobs that are hard to replace because those jobs were fundamentally a way of life? Farming was once the most common job in this country. Now, though, agriculture is so high-tech, fewer farmers are needed to work the fields, which is in turn trickling down to the towns that once thrived on farm economies. Today, in the first of a new series called, fittingly enough, Way of Life, Luke Runyon from KUNC and Harvest Public Media brings us the story of one farm community that's been shrinking even as its farms grow bigger.
Brandon Biesmeyer climbs up a small ladder into a green and yellow tractor.
So what do you want to do? You want to go for a ride? You want to...
Yeah, let's go for a ride.
All right, sounds good.
We're heading out to spray an herbicide on his cornfields. In the cab, on a computer screen, a little pixelated tractor moves across, showing what we've sprayed.
It turns everything blue that we've hit. And I think sometimes you get so focused on this screen that you forget what you're even doing.
This is just one piece of expensive equipment on the Biesmeyer family farm. There's a huge combine and a corn planter. And these machines allow Biesmeyer and his brother to farm nearly 7,000 acres in this rural pocket of northeastern Colorado. Just a few decades ago, it'd be unheard of for a family to manage that much cropland. Now, Biesmeyer says, this is a medium-sized farm in this part of the plains.
It takes a lot of acres to pay that combine off, or that corn planter off, or that sprayer off.
And that means farms have to grow in size to make ends meet. You can't just farm 80 acres and make a living, he says.
I wish you could. I think life would be a lot simpler and easier, and there'd be just a lot more people out here, I think, if that was the case.
Biesmeyer lives with his wife and two kids in the nearby town of Haxton, Colorado, population 917. That's 200 fewer people than when the town was at its peak in 1920.
The equipment is bigger and just takes more to farm, and the cost is tremendous.
That's Brandon Biesmeyer's grandfather, Quentin. He goes by Bud. When he started farming back in the late 1940s, Haxton was bustling with activity.
Well, there was just more people. We'd come to town Saturday night, and the street was lined with cars, and they had a movie theater here.
And a bowling alley, some restaurants. But those are gone now, either knocked down or standing empty.
When I moved here in 84, there was a dress store, there was a fabric store, there were three or four barbers.
Darcy Gerritsen is the superintendent and principal of Haxton's public school.
All kinds of things that are no longer here because people can drive 30 miles to Walmart, and everybody does.
Still, it's not all doom and gloom in Haxton. Parts of the town's economy are thriving, despite the declining number of farmers. Those bigger farms need more services, more agriculture specialists they can hire to help out. Like Dave Gibson. I met him out in a cornfield at the edge of town.
My grandfather was a farmer, and my dad was a sharecropper, and then now I'm an agronomist, so I just farm vicariously through others.
Gibson does everything from soil sampling to mixing farm chemicals, so farmers can focus on staying in the field.
When you talk about what's going to keep our town alive, our little town of Haxton, it's going to be kids coming home, coming back to farm.
If that next generation doesn't want to farm, then Gibson says you could see the same trends continuing, the surviving farms getting bigger and the nearby towns getting smaller. In Haxton, Colorado, I'm Luke Runyon for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It runs just as great as all the other diesels that I've driven here.
Natural gas keeps on trucking. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is off just 5 points today, 21,408. NASDAQ was up 23. It's about 0.3%, 61.76. S&P 500 up 2 points less than a 0.1%, 24.27. Today in Notes from the Retail Slump, Abercrombie & Fitch, infamous or famous perhaps, depending on how you look at it. For sexy preppy models with abs galore, the retailer has struggled. Now talks with potential buyers have shut down. Stock down 21% today. Ouch. Owner of Saks Fifth Avenue, Canada's Hudson Bay Company, faces pressure from investors to focus on real estate, which means maybe turn some of that fancy store space that's not working so well into office space or apartments. Hudson's Bay Company down 1.7% today. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury down to 2.37%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is in the Middle East this week for his first experience in shuttle diplomacy. He's literally shuttling between Qatar and its neighbors, trying to get negotiations going and restore some of those economic relationships. Last month, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Egypt cut diplomatic ties with Qatar, which meant trouble for Qatari businesses and, as it turns out, in the short term anyway, the global supply of helium. Sarah Zhang has been covering this story for The Atlantic. Thanks for coming on the program.
Thanks for having me.
Why don't you run down the list of things for me that we need helium for other than, like, birthday party balloons?
Yeah, helium is actually surprisingly important in a lot of things, right? So it's one of the lightest elements. So that means scientists and doctors use it in, like, MRI scanners. Mm-hmm. It's also used in the Large Hadron Collider. It's also really good for using in making semiconductors that are in your computer chips. And, of course, it's really light, as we all know. So it's used in airships and helium balloons.
And those balloons, yeah. Tell me now how this crisis of sorts between Qatar and its Gulf neighbors is factoring into the global helium market.
Yeah, so Qatar is one of the largest suppliers of helium. It's actually second right behind the U.S., supplies about a third of the world's helium. Hmm. And what it usually does is that it sends its helium to Saudi Arabia and then to the UAE, where it leaves a big port in these specialized containers that goes off to Singapore and the rest of the world. So Saudi Arabia and UAE have cut off that route. So it did result in a kind of a short-term ending in production, but it's since restarted. They found another way to get it through, but the port is smaller, the boats are smaller. And because liquid helium is really, really cold, those containers also have to be really, really cold. And you can't just cool them down right away because they'll crack. So they kind of have to, like, slowly cool over days.
So what has happened then to helium prices? I mean, have we seen it reflected in prices in the global market?
So this has been a pretty short-term hiccup. But the larger context here is that there's been a lot of instability and drama in the helium market in the past few years. Qatar actually only started producing helium around 2013 after a bunch of shortages. So Qatar wasn't really seen as a place that was super risky politically. But now they're starting to really, really reevaluate that and hope that there might be other sources of helium elsewhere in the world.
And it's a little bit of an inelastic supply, right? You can only get more helium by getting more natural gas out of the ground, and that creates its own supply chain problems.
Yeah, that's exactly it. So one of the reasons the U.S. and actually Qatar are the two biggest producers of helium is because they make a lot of natural gas. So helium is kind of present in, like, really, really low quantities in natural gas. In Qatar, it's about 0.05% of a natural gas. Hmm. So usually, in a lot of cases, you know, it's just kind of vented off as waste because it's not enough to really make any money from it. But because Qatar produces so much natural gas and they do something called liquefying it, they're able to actually produce enough helium to make some money on it.
We should be clear here that there is plenty of helium out there in the world. It's not like we're running out. It's a supply chain thing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. There's plenty of helium on Earth. It's one of the most abundant elements in the universe. So there's a lot of helium in the universe. So there has been a really exciting development in the helium world, which is a discovery.
I love that you're excited about it. That's great.
The industry is really excited. A discovery announced last year, actually a rediscovery. People are looking at old British maps, and they found there's actually a huge helium deposit in Tanzania. And here the helium is actually high enough that you could extract it just for the helium alone. So people are hoping that maybe we could do that, and that can be acting as a buffer against other supply shocks in the future.
And are things calming down now in light of the Qatar situation?
Well, with respect to helium, yes. And the other parts, not so much.
Right, of course. Sarah Zhang, she writes for The Atlantic most recently about the global helium market. Sarah, thanks so much.
Hi, thank you.
Here with a story about good intentions gone wrong. About a decade ago, the two big cargo ports here in Southern California, Los Angeles and Long Beach, decided they had to do something about all the pollution coming from all the trucks hauling cargo in and out of the region. So they offered hundreds of millions of dollars in incentives for trucking companies to ditch their heavy diesel rigs and switch to something more environmentally friendly, like trucks powered by liquefied natural gas. It went, as you're about to hear, badly. So badly that many truckers said they would never drive a natural gas-powered truck again. But natural gas companies are trying once more. KPCC's Emily Guerin reports.
I'm going to start this story with a little public radio cliche. The sound of someone firing up a truck engine. I wanted you to hear this, though, because it's significant that this truck actually starts. This is the latest generation of natural gas-powered trucks. The older trucks often sounded more like this when you turned the ignition before conking out altogether. The memory of those older trucks was on a lot of people's minds at a recent workshop to introduce the new trucks to skeptical drivers. It was put on by natural gas companies looking for a second chance. The first step in asking for forgiveness, acknowledge your mistake.
Believe me, I've heard all the horror stories.
That's Long Beach Harbor Commissioner Rich Dines talking to a room full of about 100 people.
And there's been a lot of them, and they just don't work.
He's talking about a clean truck program pushed by the ports of Long Beach and Los Angeles in 2009. Trucking companies got huge subsidies to buy 900 new natural gas-powered trucks. But the rigs broke down a lot. And many drivers sold them as soon as they could, often for pennies on the dollar. So while the program did clean up the air, it left a lot of drivers bitter and distrustful. Now the ports have a new goal: cut greenhouse gas emissions by 80%. To do it, they need to rely on the next generation of natural gas trucks. Here's Dines again.
I am hopeful that, you know, the technology has improved so much that we won't have those problems.
One of those problems was that the new engines hadn't been field tested in trucks that needed to haul 20,000-pound cargo containers.
The key for us is that, I hate to say this, but we will not trust the manufacturer. We want to test the technology.
That's Vic LaRosa. His trucking company, TTSI, bought 65 of the original natural gas rigs and had just as terrible an experience as so many other companies. But he hasn't turned his back on the technology because he wants to do his part to clean up diesel trucks. He knows they're the number one cause of smog in the LA basin.
Our corporate goal is to get to zero emission. We want to be the first zero emission fleet.
For the past couple months, he's been working with the ports and truck manufacturer Cummins Westport to test the latest natural gas truck. Driver Ryan Sickles is the guinea pig driving that new generation truck we heard at the top of this story.
This truck has great power. I mean, I've hauled all sorts and all different weights of containers, and it runs just as great as all the other diesels that I've driven here.
The natural gas vehicle industry hopes Sickles and others will become the poster children for these new trucks. Rob Knightsky is the CEO of Cummins Westport.
If we can get a couple of these guys to say, hey, I drove these trucks and here's how they worked for me, again, I think that's better than Rob saying it.
Alejandra Rojas isn't so sure about that. She manages the small port trucking company Atlas Marine. She sat through the entire workshop sponsored by the natural gas companies in the ports. But she said the testimonials did not convince her that the organizers understood the reality of a small port trucking company like Atlas Marine. Profit margins are slim, and unexpected costs to maintain trucks can be devastating.
We have the good intentions to keep the air clean, but financially, is going to be a big burden on the company.
Natural gas companies have a big incentive to change her mind. They provide the fuel for the trucks, after all. But Rojas is skeptical that these companies even care about the environment. They didn't even have recycling, she told me, while pointing at all the plastic water bottles in the trash at the workshop. If you're trying to win back people's trust, details matter. I'm Emily Guerin for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which the lesson is business models aren't interchangeable, y'all. There are some people over in China who saw all those bike sharing programs that have caught on here and over there as well, and they thought, hey, you know what would be really great? An umbrella sharing company. True story comes to us from the South China Morning Post. The company is called Sharing E-Umbrella. You pay a 19 yuan deposit, about $275 American. You take an umbrella and... well, you can see where this is going, right? Just a couple of weeks after starting up in 11 cities across China, Sharing E-Umbrella has announced that it's lost almost all of its 300,000 umbrellas. All right, we got to go. The Dow off just 5 points today, bupkis percentage-wise. NASDAQ up 23 points, about 0.3%. S&P 500 up 2 points, also bupkis, I think is a technical term. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonder, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.